Hi, welcome to the Penis Project podcast. This is the place to come to find out everything you've always wanted to know about men's health but were too embarrassed to ask. Join physiotherapist Dr. Joe Milios and sexologist nurse practitioner Melissa Hadley-Barrett as they talk to real men and the experts about men's private parts. Have a burning question you really want to know the answer to? Please subscribe to our website at thepenisproject.org and ask us.
The more time I've got for you. There's too much talking, texting, tweeting, posting. Too much noise altogether. In silence is strength and peace and space. Imagine silent forever.
The Penis Project podcast is proudly supported and sponsored by PROST, Exercise for Prostate Cancer Incorporated, a not-for-profit charity set up in 2012 by myself, Dr. Joe Milios. If you want to know any more information about PROST, including our online service now available, please just go to prost.com.au. PROST means cheers to your health, so PROST to you. Where I want to call my home.
So stop for a second and listen. Not silent at all. So, welcome to the Penis Project. Today we have the pirate with the wooden leg, and soon you'll find out that leg is an interchangeable word with something else. So, we are talking to the pirate today about his journey when he was first diagnosed with bowel cancer at 49 and how this went on. And it seems like that's a long way away from a penis problem, but actually, you'll be surprised to hear that having a diagnosis and surgery for bowel cancer actually does affect your penis. So, Mr. Pirate, how are you today?
Very good, thanks, Mel.
Thanks heaps for coming in. Now, you've come a really long way, and we're not going to say where because we're not going to identify you, but you've come from rural, remote Western Australia. And fortunately for me, we're actually talking face-to-face, so that's great. So tell me a little bit about, well, you've told me before, but tell me so for the listeners can hear about your journey of actually getting diagnosed with your bowel cancer. That was a trick for you, wasn't it? And I think this is a problem that lots of rural people face. So tell us about that.
Yeah, thanks, Mel. So what happened with me is that it probably wasn't so known back then that men would talk about these things. I had some bleeding and thought, you know, I'll see the doctor, and he suggested it's probably hemorrhoids or, you know, a fissure or something along those lines. So usual, get the cream, away you go, and think everything's okay. It progressively got worse, and I recall going away actually to Bali and, you know, eating hot food, and it was quite distressing how much blood was actually there. So I went and saw the doctor again. He said, well, we'll book you in for a colonoscopy the first two times, because being remote, you know, just, you know, and I was on the public system then. So I went two times to go and have that. And they said, no, you're too young. You know, there's no concerns here.
You had to drive quite a long distance, didn't you, to even have the colonoscopy? And then you got there and they turned you away. Is that right?
Yeah, basically he said, well, you know, we don't classifies your situation as urgent, you know, too young. So went back a couple of times, and then it was my 49th birthday that I went back. And I was first cab off the rank, went in, and I come to, and I actually knew some of the people at the hospital, and I could see one of them, you know, through my mask of coming out of the twilight, that she was in tears and obviously knew the implications of what was found.
So how long from when you first noticed the rectal bleeding to when you finally got to have that? What was the time frame between those two things?
Probably 12 months.
Yeah, so it's a long time, isn't it? Yeah.
I feel so, but I mean, again, I can't, there's no point going backwards.
No.
You know, my doctor back then was, you know, very experienced, and I guess, you know, you have that unpleasant experience of being inspected, and he seemed to think that, again, it was just a fissure or something like that. It is a bit surprising to me because it was very close. It was only like a centimetre from my, you know, my anus, and I would have thought that it possibly would have been detected as being a rectal carcinoma.
So that's what you were just, so you were diagnosed with a rectal carcinoma, and then what happened next? Then you had to leave and go to the city, I'm assuming.
What happened then was I went back to my hometown, and a lovely man, Mr. Levitt, called me, and he, Michael Levitt, and said, I think I might be able to help you. And, you know, I was just still in shock, obviously. And I said, that's an understatement. He wanted me in Perth the next day, which was simply impossible. Next week, I went to Perth and met with Michael. And he was just amazing. He staged everything from there. Like, he obviously had to get up on the bench again and go through the pain of that indignifying inspection. But then he straight away was on the phone to, you know, Charlie's, organised oncology with a guy called Dr. Spry, who was in charge back then. That day I actually left his rooms and went to Charlie's and met with Mr. Spry, and he, again, I had to get on the couch again. So wasn't much fun, but he mapped out and said, right, this is what we do, and then you start preoperative chemo radio. And that, you know, down into Crawford Lodge, quite a displacement, you know, because you're not really knowing what's ahead of you. So, yeah, it was, I would try to book in as early as I could to go and have radio, and then, you know, the 5FU, the pump, you know, I had to go through that surgery to get the infuser port put in.
So just for those listening, that means that he got radiation straight away, and that was to reduce the size of the tumour, I'm assuming, and then also chemotherapy for the same, because the tumour was too large for surgery straight away. Is that correct?
Yeah, they have a code. I can't, I think it was a T3. It, you know, no metastasizing or lymph nodes affected, but it's not until they actually go in to do surgery. But back then, you know, Michael explained to me, Dr. Levitt, that this is the way they treated. This is the way that they want to get as much circumference around the tumour as possible to give you the best possible chance.
Yeah. Okay. So this was when you were 49. So how long did you have to, how old are you now, actually?
I'm 62.
Right. So this is, so you've had a really good longevity following this. You must have been scared. Were you scared for your own, like, mortality at that time?
Absolutely. And you know, obviously for my family as well, you know, I had a young daughter and young wife or partner. So, yeah, it was quite confronting.
And also you were running your own business as well, so time away from that would have, so suddenly would have been difficult as well?
Absolutely. Like, so I was away for months, and, you know, I'm just lucky that my partner just stepped up. You know, we had jobs, not just, you know, where I live, but in other places in the Northwest, and her and her father took the reins. And yeah, I was given instructions over the phone. You never had any FaceTime or any of that back then. And yeah, it was amazing what they did. So yeah, that went on for months. And then obviously after surgery, then I, you know, I still had to recover from that and then have post-operative chemo and radio.
So you had the chemo and radiation to reduce the size, then you had the surgery, and then from the surgery the tumour was so large that you needed to have a bag, didn't you, a stoma?
No, that's not totally correct.
So what happened?
I got told when I first had the colonoscopy that it was too close. You know, with bowel cancer, and you're aware, I guess, that if it's too close to your anus, then they can't reinvent an anus. So you have to actually, I had half a metre of the bowel out, and there was no option for me. Some there is, but in my case there wasn't. So in January, after the few months and a bit of time for that to settle down, I was booked in to have surgery with Mr. Levitt.
And when you woke up, I mean, you obviously went into the surgery knowing you were going to get a stoma and a bag. From then on, you were going to have, and we'll, just so that people understand, this means that now when Mr. Pirate has his bowels opened, it actually comes through a bag on his stomach, and his anus is now no longer it's stitched up, isn't it? So,
yeah, that's right. So I don't recall exact time of how long the operation was, but Mr. Levitt did the what they call the clean part of the operation, which is the stoma insertion, and then another team was doing down below removal of, you know, I guess he oversees everything, but that team is the dirty part of the, if you will, of removing that half a metre of bowel.
Yeah.
And, yeah, like you. So I knew, but you still, you don't realise until you wake up, you know. And when I come to, I was in intensive care, obviously, and lots of drugs, and I don't remember, but my children and people visiting.
Mm-hmm.
But straight away after a few days, I knew things had changed massively as far as even my sexuality with, you know, my penis and that type of thing. It was something, because the nerves around that area, once they're severed, it's not prostate cancer, but the symptoms are very similar.
Yeah, and I think that's something people don't realise, is that everyone knows really that prostate cancer affects your erections and your sexual function, but I think people don't often think about these other kind of surgeries, such as bowel cancer or any really pelvic surgery, can affect your sexual function. And were you told before this surgery that that was going to affect your sexual function, or was it just so focused on getting rid of the cancer that that wasn't really discussed?
Oh, look, I think you know, you hope for the best.
Yeah.
But Mr. Levitt pointed out what some of these issues could be.
Mm-hmm.
And I can only talk for myself that, yeah, I could tell straight away. You know, just there wasn't that feeling there. And, so it was quite weird. I didn't know what to expect, but you're also not focused on that necessarily then.
No,
it's just when I think back, you know, straight away, you know, you're in hospital for, it was 2.5 weeks, and those things sort of come back later on. Oh, yeah, it certainly, you know, changed, because even right up until I had the surgery, even when I was having chemo, I mean, that part of my body still functioned okay.
Yep. So you're still waking up with a bit of morning.
Yeah, that type of thing.
Yeah.
And you could still have, an outward orgasm.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, that was just part of the recovery, that there's a realization that that part of your body or that organ is not functioning how it used to.
And then, so tell me how you felt when you looked at the stoma for the first time. Did that surprise you, or was that what you were expecting? How did you feel about it?
It's quite weird, because you go there and you get marked up with a pen where things are going to go.
Mm-hmm.
Mine's on the left side, whereas people that have, you know, irritable bowel, generally on the right sometimes, because it's a different part of their intestines that are affected.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, again, quite a shock. I mean, you look and go, well, okay, it's done. And I've got to be honest, I mean, the stoma nurse and that, they're brilliant, but it's hard because you don't know what products you're going to use. So just for you, I mean, you don't really go to the toilet for probably a week anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You're recovering, you know, it's a fairly massive dose of you know, snake poison that you get.
Definitely.
And your whole body sort of shuts down. But, yeah, obviously I had a lot of stitches in my rear end and, you know, this at the front. And it wasn't until I got out of hospital and went to the Ostomy Association that I started getting some information that was very helpful.
Yeah, and they taught you how to change your bags and all of those things?
Well, I went to Maylands and the founding member in WA, a guy called Peter McCormack, Peter McCormack's no longer with us.
Mm-hmm.
He told me when he got his stoma like 30 years ago, you know, and how ancient the technology was back then.
Mm.
And I looked on the wall and there's like so many different sizes of bags, you know, ones for babies. And I just thought to myself, well, you know, yeah, you're 50 and you're going to have a bag, but what about babies that are born like that? Or, you know, so there's always someone in a worse position than you is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I get that. But it's still all relative to you. You know, you've gone from being this healthy, active 49-year-old to a 50-year-old man that now poos into a bag, and imagine, and your penis isn't functioning like it used to, and all of that must have been really confronting for you. And you've been separated from your family.
Yes. And, you know, and above that, then you've got to start facing up to the post-operative chemo and radio as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, where I live's quite hot, but the one thing I wanted to do was not leave my family again, because I think at that stage we'd all been through enough. So I actually went down the path of trying to get chemo. There was no radio post-operative in the town that I lived, and I can say and put my hand up that I was the only one ever to do that, because it just logistically got too hard. You're sending 5FU, it ended up in a different place once, and we had to train a couple of nurses, and, you know, absolutely magnificent, because you've got to obviously flush the infuser port every week as well, and then change, you know, that pump.
Yeah, and but, it's not something that nurses in a remote rural area would do very often, so that would have been a whole new learning experience for them as well.
It was, and I still see those people and commend them for what they did. There's a lot of challenges and a lot of changes in my life that happened in a very short period of time, and not just mine, obviously my family's who, I'm very proud of. I mean, I'm lucky that my partner, although she's worked with me, is also a surgical nurse in a prior life. So she understood the challenges that were affront. And, yeah, I there's no way I could be sitting here today if it wasn't for their support.
Yeah, that's great. And I think I'd really like to acknowledge those health professionals in your town for, like, stepping up to that, because having worked in remote areas for a lot of my career, it's like you become a bit of a jack of all trades and a master of nothing. And, you know, if you didn't have those people in those areas, like those nurses who learnt those new skills, you would have had to have stayed away from your family for a lot longer. So
absolutely. But I will add, you know, that was the first and only time, because it was just too difficult logistically.
Yeah.
I acknowledge them. I also acknowledge the support right through the network, you know, from Mr. Levitt to, you know, the whole cancer team at Charlie's. You know, they were absolutely magnificent. And, you know, with all the grief, there were some pretty funny times as well. we haven't got time for that. But, yeah, I can recall once going to have my daily dose of radiation, and my needle had come out from the infuser port. So I had to sort of get to B-block had the chemo back then. Mm-hmm. Anyway, they didn't have any heparin there. Heparin, is that what it is? Yeah, thing they flush it with. So I had to dash underneath all the tunnels, and this security guard saw me, and he was chasing me through the tunnels because he had the green gown on. He thought I'd
you'd escaped.
Got out the psychiatric ward. And so I'm running down the alleyway and saying, I've got to get over there. And he says, no, you get back here. And anyway, it was quite funny that we both arrived puffing and panting, and they said, no, he's one of ours. It's okay. So,
he's doing a runner.
Yeah.
That's funny. So tell me about the first time that you tried to be intimate with your wife and you or your partner, and you had this bag. Like, how did you feel about that? Were you worried about it?
Oh, look, of course you are. And I think that you know, there was a lot of time in between that as well. You know, that wasn't the foremost thing that you think of.
Of course.
You know, there's a lot of scarring there. Your body, you look at it and you go, my God, you know, in the mirror, and it's not the same.
Yeah.
So I guess, you know, you cover up with the shirt, a T-shirt.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that still probably goes on today. It's not that I'm ashamed of it. I just, you know, I'm a lot more conservative at where I'm at life.
Sure.
You know, I've got a few bloody scruffy mates, one in particular that says, oh, you know, show us your bloody bitch, you know, and tries to make light of it. But, yeah, anyway, it is something that's very confronting initially, but then what's your options?
Yeah.
Your options are going into a box, and sadly, you know, a lot, even if they do all that, don't make it. And I've got people I know, friends that have suffered that, gone through all that, and sadly are not here anymore.
Yeah.
I'm the lucky one.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's still, so when did you realise, I know that you said looking back that you realised that your erectile function had changed straight away, but when did it become a real issue for you that you decided to take the next steps?
Well, you know, it took probably quite a few months mm-hmm. of, you know, having a flaccid penis to sort of think, well, okay, you could still, two things, you could still have an orgasm.
Mm-hmm.
Without putting finer point on a floppy dick orgasm, which is not much fun.
Yeah.
And secondly, that you don't have an outward orgasm, a bit like guys that have prostate.
Yeah, so there's no ejaculate anymore.
No. So that goes back into your
bladder. Yeah.
So then I, after time, I got referred to Dr. Miller.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you told me he's recently retired.
I think he's still practicing out of down south, but yeah. But not in the city anymore. Yeah.
So we went through. He had an offsider too. I didn't actually see Dr. Miller initially. It was a guy before. I can't recall his name. But we went through the different pros and cons. We tried Viagra or Cialis.
Yeah, Cialis. That's right. Yep.
Just gave me a bloody. Did nothing for that head, just give me a massive headache.
So your little head didn't respond and your big head was banging.
little head was, and then, the pump, tried the old pump to blow it up, and that wasn't successful. I guess you go through all those things.
Of course.
Then I went and he said, well, you know, you can get an injection.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the thought of that's quite, you know, you go, ouch, but...
Yeah.
We tried a little bit and it worked. So, you know, I proceeded to get scripts of that for probably about 7 or 8 years.
And that, just out of interest, did you find it painful at all? Like, there's no pain, is there, when you gave yourself the injection?
Well, you could say that, but if I tried to do it on someone else, I'm sure they would say different.
Yeah.
It's not painless, no.
No, okay.
It's after you get used to it for a while, you know what you're in for, but there's other issues with it. It's not something that you can, you know, you can't, it's spontaneous, you know, you more or less have to plan it.
Yeah, that's the biggest complaint I have from my patients is that it's just a lack of spontaneity. And you and your partner were still quite sexually active, and so eventually you decided that, you know, injections might have given you an erection, but they weren't the be-all and end-all for you, so you went to the next stage, didn't you?
Well, that's right. I mean, you try and put a sneaky needle in and sort of say, oh, I come home, you know, like put a bow tie on there or whatever. But it was still quite, you know, cumbersome. And
So
I started getting, a curvature.
Yes.
And also some scarring. So I went back to Dr. Miller and I said, well, you know, where do we go from here?
Mm-hmm.
And he suggested Dr. LaBianca go and have a chat with him. So, and the other thing was it wasn't working anymore.
Right. So the injection stopped.
Yeah.
Stopped being effective.
I kept putting more and more and more and it just wouldn't happen.
Sure. Yeah.
So I went and booked an appointment. Well, actually, he gave me a referral to Dr. Shane LaBianca,
mm-hmm.
who was amazing. You know, he sort of go there and you lie up and he sizes you up, and I mean I don't have a lot to work with, so I was a bit cautious.
All men say they don't have a lot to work with and most of them are all completely normal.
he sort of said, yep, we can make this work, and which was, because after I did it I thought, why didn't I do this, you know, 5 years ago? But I guess the technology's come a long way.
That's right. So what year did you have your implant put in?
Look, I think it would be 2007, around that time. I'd have to have a look, but it's been 4 years.
Yeah, great.
Or so, and it's worked absolutely brilliantly. Like, as I said, if I had that choice again, I would have done it
earlier,
because you can be spontaneous and it's immediate, you know, it's third ball and, you know, you pump and magic, you know.
Yeah. And so immediately post-op, like the experience that I've been having with my clients who have had it done is that they don't like me very much for the referral in the first 2 weeks because it's quite uncomfortable. And then after that, they love it. What was your immediate post-op experience like?
Well, I think it's just typical blokes that you want to get things cranking.
Got a new toy, you got to play with it.
As soon as possible. And I made that mistake.
Mm-hmm.
My partner just said, don't be a dickhead. Or let your inhibitions get mixed up with your capabilities.
Yeah.
You're not ready. Mm-hmm. And if you do, and, you know, Kavita had said too, don't try and crack things too early.
Now, Kavita's the wonderful nurse that works with Shane, isn't she?
Yes.
Yep.
And she is. So, of course, you know, you try it on, but, you need to give it a good couple of months, 2 to 3 months minimum before mm-hmm. it's fully functional, because it's, yeah, there's a lot of healing, like everything, to take place.
Yeah. And so once, just out of interest, you know, when you started using it, what was the sensation like for you? Was it as good as it, or better than it was with the injections? And how did everything feel for you when you were actually having intercourse with your implant?
Well, initially, it hadn't worked with the needle for a long time anyway.
Yeah.
So it was quite some time before we could actually, you know, do things successfully with the pump.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was, once it settled down, once the post-operative stuff settled down, it was far better in
Great.
My view.
Yeah. And your sensation felt good?
Well, sensation was good, but also the peristium, you know, like,
oh, your peroneus. Yeah, you didn't, so your bentness was all straight, because because Shane would have straightened it out for you at the same time.
That's right.
Yeah, great.
So that was good, and it was very successful.
Yeah, fantastic. So, and now I know recently, and this is how you and I came to meet, they started sending a stoma nurse to the town you live in. And has that been good for you, like having that sort of support?
Oh, look, Tanya's amazing. You know, she's just, again, another one of the network of help that's there. And I happened to mention a few little issues because I didn't know that she actually worked here at PUC or in this hospital and knew Kavita.
Yes.
So it just goes to show how incestuous the industry is, I guess.
Yeah, but we all know each other. Yeah.
So I chatted with her about, my developing issue.
Yeah.
With the wooden leg. And, last year I had some cardiology tests done, and he suggested that I change medications. Now, initially I thought it could be something to do with medications, and we're still unsure what it is, but I started getting a lack of sensation in my penis.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I'm not sure, still don't know what's caused it, but it just inhibits me having an orgasm.
And that started just about the same time that you also started those new medications?
Yeah, probably 6 to 8 months ago. So it's just working through that. I'll add that I've been on a fairly, after the cardiologist, he'd suggested that I needed to get serious about losing weight and lifestyle change. So I've been doing a lot of exercise as well. And you mentioned to me that it could be the long bike rides that could cause an area in the peristeenium area. But
yeah.
So
for the listeners out there, Mr. Pirate and I met because Tanya, the stoma therapist who's been visiting the town he lives in, put us in contact. And he was telling me how he has had difficulty having an orgasm since he's been on those medications, but he was also doing a lot of bike riding, and bike riding can put a lot of pressure on those nerves down in the perineum, and that can cause anorgasmia, which is the problem that you're having. So we're not really sure, are we, whether or not it's the bike riding, the medication, a combination of those things.
Or just getting old. I don't know.
It could be that too.
But I did look up what it was, and that is the word.
Yeah.
It's certainly no reflection on my partner or anything like that. It's just a condition that's developed.
And yeah, that's right. And it's not uncommon. And you know, and I think that's so fantastic that you're concerned about your partner feeling how she feels about that, because I think that's a common thing with us women as we age. We figure that if something goes wrong sexually with our male partner, that it's because we've got hail damage or a bit wrinklier than we used to be, and we blame ourselves. So it's so nice that you're aware of that for her.
Oh, look, there's no difference for me. I mean, it same as when she was, when I met her in her, you know, 20s. I mean, she still was gorgeous and I'm very lucky. Yeah. So it's not that, it's to do with me, and that's why I'm trying to sort it out, because it is rather frustrating that,
I'm sure,
from one day to the next, really. It hasn't happened over years. This has happened in months that I've had this anti-orgasmia situation arise.
Yeah. So back to your weight loss though. So you've been, your brother had a heart attack, didn't he? And that sort of spurred you along, is that right, to lose some weight?
And he did. And he'll certainly know who this is now after the, because he had it last year. He's younger than me.
Right.
In having said that too, his diet wasn't exactly good. He wasn't like, you know, grossly overweight, but I remember being down in Perth and he said, oh, I don't feel well. And everyone's going, oh, come on, you know, toughen up a bit. And lo and behold, I get back. I think I get a phone call that he's had a heart attack.
Mm-hmm.
Minor. And they rushed him straight in and stents. But that prompted me to, I'd always wanted to go and check out because obviously my health history. And I went and saw cardiologist. Well, I saw the GP to refer me to a cardiologist. And Dr. Abraham with IMED, and he took all these tests. My calcium score was just ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
And without going into finer detail, he just said, if you don't make some changes, you're not going to be around. So, yeah, and I feel great. You know, I worked hard and
so how much weight have you lost?
A bit north of 20, so.
Wow. And do you feel better for it? Like, do you have more energy? And
When I'm not falling asleep at 8 o'clock, I get up early and, you know, take the dog, and it's just you got to get into that routine, you know, and if you don't do it, you feel guilty. So, yeah, I guess I'm doing two stints of exercise a day, generally, a 9 or 10K sort of, I can't run, but it's like a Cliffy Young shuffle.
Yeah.
And then, a bike ride in the afternoon.
Great. And so that's interesting, isn't it? Like, you're kind of a bit more like a cat than a pirate. You've, like, fought death a few times so far, haven't you? Your heart, your bowel cancer, yeah.
Well, there's been others. I haven't even mentioned the back operations or the shoulder operation and whatever. It sucks getting old. And I'm not even really that old.
No.
But, you know, on the other side of it, I'm lucky. You know, the sun comes up another day for me and I'm just grateful. And I think I said to you earlier that I want to get, you know, my goal was to get my daughter's 21st, and that's not far away.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, for all intents and purposes, it seems like you've done really well. You know, you've changed your lifestyle factors. You've got rid of the cancer. It hasn't come back over all of this time. And yep, getting old does suck, but it sucks more being dead, doesn't it? So,
well, let's hope I don't know about that for a while. But
yeah.
Certainly there's a lot of challenges, you know, from that day of finding out. You know, it's now 14 years ago or so, and then, you know, getting your all clear, you know, after 5 years, and then still having to go and do regular bloods. And I had bloods done recently, and they've never been, you know, cholesterol's never been under 3. And so I'm very happy with that part of my life.
I often think that when people get diagnosed with a serious illness, it often makes them really pay more attention to the rest of the health of their body. We sort of take it for granted. And then when a bit doesn't work as well as it should, makes us pay attention to the rest of it.
Yeah, I agree. But, you know, there's another side of it, and that's why I'm here today. You know, if you can help someone else, like I've got a friend that I know where his ex-wife is just exactly the same as me. She's 49, bowel cancer, rectal carcinoma, probably going to go down the same journey. And where I live, there's quite a few guys that would come to me that had bleeding. I can tell you a million stories. One guy thought he was dying, and then we worked out he'd eaten too much beetroot the night before. But, you know, there are things that erectile dysfunction or cancer or different things, if you've been on that journey, you've got something to offer. You're not just going, you know, you're not just a nosy parker trying to, you know, be find out what's going on. Yeah. You can actually, you're actually in a position to help.
Yeah, and that's precisely why Joe and I decided to start this podcast, because you can hear health professionals tell you all these things until you're blue in the face, but nothing is as valuable as a real person's story, life story.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, as much respect as I've got for Mr. Levitt and all the team, it was, you know, people like Peter McCormack that actually had a stoma, and, you know, he sat me down and just said, you know, these are your options, even through flushing as well. He said, well, this is what I do, you know. He flushed every day, you know, used to take 2 hours, which wasn't going to suit me. But So those people have had the lifetime experience for real are the ones that, you know, you can benefit from, I think.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. So I kind of am thinking about this as like a few takeaways from what you've told us today. One is, you know, if you have any kind of health problem that you're concerned about, no one knows your body as well as you do. And, you know, you had to be really persistent to get your diagnosis and eventually get treated. So I think that's great. Lots of people would have just gone for, you know, oh, well, they said there's nothing wrong, I'm too young, and left it. And then that could have been a much worse situation for you. So good on you for that. And the other thing is being open and talking about these things so that you can be a resource for other people. Is there anything else that you would really like to get out there?
Just don't screw around. You know, like I don't, if I'm not happy with the advice I've been given, you know, particularly in country areas, I'm not knocking them, but you need to get to a major centre, Perth or whatever, to get the specialist treatment you need. And if you've got to pay for that, don't muck around. You know, I know that everybody can't afford it, but I've got to say, right through my journey, I was very, I didn't have private cover back then, but it was amazing, you know, and hats off that when you're really ill, you know, that system kicks in. And they knew that they could save me, and they did.
Yeah.
You know, and as an example, I've got a friend that was a neighbour of mine that had private cover. He couldn't be saved. So the sooner you get it, you know, if it's bleeding or whatever else, don't muck around. Just get there and get it sorted.
Yeah, I totally agree. And get a second opinion, because nobody knows this, that your body isn't right as well as you do. So, you know, I think often, unfortunately, people are too keen to take the health professional's advice on the face value and don't trust their own intuition. And you've a perfect example of someone who trusted your own intuition, knew it wasn't right, and kept going until you got some answers. So,
well, put it this way, a lot of times I can go to a remote centre to get stuff done. I just don't muck around. I get down to Perth because that's where my history, and they know all about, you know, my background, and same with my doctor in the remote area. I've got two doctors. I've got a doctor in Perth, a GP, and a GP where I live.
Yeah.
Because where I live, I can't get to see him sometimes for 4 to 6 weeks.
Yeah, because he'll be so busy because there's hardly any people there.
Fortunately now in a position where I can just, I'm going to Perth. You know, I'll drive or I'll fly down there. And because if you don't, then, you know, you could be missing something that could cost you your life.
Yeah. Well, I'm hoping that between you and I and Shane, we can figure out this anorgasmia issue for you, and we might chat to you again sometime about what the outcome was of that. And I really appreciate you sharing your story with us. It's been fantastic. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Melissa. And I really appreciate you giving me the time to tell my story.
Great. Thank you.
I'm gonna tell you about a boy. Lives inside me. It's been there all of my life.
Hi, this is Dr. Joe. Thank you so much for listening to our program today, and we're pleased to let you know that we will be having weekly podcasts, not fortnightly as originally proposed. And this is because of the popularity of our podcast. We're getting so many emails, so many questions, and so much feedback, and Melissa and I greatly appreciate it. What we'd really love you to do is share our podcast with anyone you think might benefit, including any man in your life. Simply download off Spotify or subscribe to thepenisproject.org, and then you'll get a weekly email of our newest releases. Also, feel free to send us a review, and this will greatly help in our ongoing ability to bring you new and fresh information, as that's the way we build what comes next. We also have show notes attached, and this gives a bit of a background into any additional resources or explanations of what we're talking about. Finally, it's my great pleasure to let you know that Prost, the exercise program which sponsors our podcast, is now available on a USB resource for any man diagnosed with prostate cancer, an exercise program. Clinicians can buy these, as well as the everyday bloke. So feel free to check out prost.com.au. Meanwhile, let's keep the conversation going.
Those dread dark days, I learned to value each and every one of those warm afternoons. Boys on their bikes, shooting stones at each other through the trees. We tried to deny the going down of the sun. We're just having too much fun. And women, just a mystery.